I'm Brittany Luce, and welcome to Sampler, the show where we play you handpicked moments from podcasts that you just have to hear. Guys, today on the show, I'm going to be talking to mother podcast herself, Sarah Koenig. Sarah is the co-creator and host of a little podcast. You might have heard of it. It's called Serial. Some would say, okay, I will say that Serial put podcasting on the map. Before Serial, the number of people in the U.S. consuming podcasts grew slowly over the course of a decade. It got up to 35 million people by 2014. But then Serial struck. Since its launch, podcast consumption has surged to 60 million listeners. That means one in five people regularly listen to podcasts. We've got a special playlist of podcasts from the post-Serial world to play for Sarah today, but we'll be covering some adult topics. So if you've got kids around, this is a good time to pause and put on earbuds. Sarah Koenig, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
So you have, you're the creator of Serial, creator and host
yes.
of Serial.
Co-creator. With Julie Snyder.
With Julie Snyder.
Yeah.
So you're the co-creator of Serial with Julie Snyder. And Serial is, I guess for people who don't know, a wildly popular podcast.
Oh, come on. Who doesn't know?
No, there are people.
I'm just kidding.
Okay, I was like, no, it's actually one of the things I learned. It's really interesting, like how people, just the pockets that people sort of nestle into when they start listening to podcasts. So the first season, you focused on a Baltimore area murder case of a teenage girl that not very many people had heard about. With season two, you dig into the case of Bo Bergdahl, who's a U.S. soldier who walked off his post in Afghanistan in 2009. And was captured by the Taliban, who held him for 5 years.
Mm-hmm.
The thing about Serial is that podcasting had been around for a while. You know, the first season of Serial, that was the fastest podcast to get to 5 million downloads, which is a level of listenership.
Oh, dude, it's surpassed 200 million downloads.
Wow. 200 million downloads. It was like really the first show, you know, of this medium to really just blow the hinges off that way. And kind of in the wake of the tidal wave that was Serial, there's this like, it kind of made way for this like surge of growth in the space where there's just like this vast, weird, and like growing world of podcasts, which is, you know, good for me. It could even be argued the boost that Serial gave, I guess, the podcasting industry, it created the right environment for a company like Gimlet to really get off the ground. And, you know, in turn, Gimlet getting off the ground created my job. So thank you.
Oh, I hadn't thought of it that way. You're very welcome. I hope you're being handsomely paid. No, I feel like people are always like, why'd you do it as a podcast? And what does it mean? And what does a medium mean? And what is that? You know, and I'm always just like, oh, no, it seemed easier than doing a radio show. Like, I didn't even totally know what it was. Like, I didn't know what a podcast was really. I feel like that was what it was freeing for me, because I was like, I don't know what one is supposed to sound like, so we'll just experiment and try stuff and see if it works. And that was really helpful.
This is a Global CalLink prepaid call from
Adnan Sayed,
an inmate at a Maryland correctional facility.
From This American Life and WBEZ Chicago, it's Serial, one story told week by week. I'm Sarah Koenig.
Well, you may not have known it at the time, but, you know, your podcast ended up revolutionizing the entire medium. Serial premiered in the fall of 2014. All of the shows we're going to play for you today were created in the wake of your debut. So we're going to show you a true variety of things, and some of them may seem a little random, but, you know, stick with us. We're showing you all that has happened, you know, in Serial's wake. How does that sound?
Good.
Just like to back up a bit, you used to work with Alex Blumberg.
Yes.
Who also happens to own Gimlet and be my boss. You guys worked together at This American Life. And he told us that you used to be like super into improv.
Oh, he told you. In college, yes, I did. Yes. And a little bit after college, too.
Were you like in a troupe?
This is so embarrassing that you're making me say this out loud.
This is good. We're loving this.
I was in a group called it's hard for me to say it. Atomic pile. Okay?
Okay.
I don't even know what that means, but that's what it was called. And you know what? Until this moment, I had forgotten about Atomic Pile.
Fond memories?
Yeah. No, it was really, really fun. And I feel like making radio stories, and especially Serial, in its less stressful moments, which are few, but like, it's the same feeling of like putting on a show that I had in college. Like sometimes I think like all of this that I'm doing is just trying to recapture that like total ridiculous, goofy freedom of college, of college theater.
So the first clip that I'm going to play you is from a show called Hello from the Magic Tavern. We picked this one because it's an improv podcast. So this podcast is actually kind of difficult to explain. So I'm going to let the host, Arnie, and his co-host, someone named Chunt, explain it themselves.
Hello from the Magic Tavern, a weekly podcast from the magical land of Foon. I'm your host, Arnie Niekamp. If you've never listened to the podcast before, this is what's going on. A year and a week ago, I fell through a dimensional portal behind a Burger King in Chicago into the fantastical land of Foon. I'm still getting a slight Wi-Fi signal from the Burger King through that dimensional rift, and I use it to upload a podcast I record every week here in the tavern, the Vermilion Minotaur, in the town of Hog's Face, in the land of Foon. I interview monsters, adventurers, royalty.
At this table.
At this very table.
So on this episode, their guest is this guy, Tom Blaine, who was a prince in the land of Foon, but he is now an actor. So Arnie and Chunt ask Tom about his budding acting career in the magical land of Foon.
Hey, I'm so excited to have Tom the Traveler back.
Yes, well, I think we all know what my real identity is.
Tom Blaine Belleroth, Prince of the Belleroth Empire.
And possible winner of a Tosser Award.
No, oh. I am what? Not.
Oh. You're still Tosser nominated.
I am like you, Chunt, in that I am cursed.
Well, for new listeners, what is the Tosser? Like, you left the Northeast, where you're the prince.
Yes.
And you became an actor.
I hid away to drop the role of prince and become something else. And I joined a group called the Cocktickers. And
wonderful acting troupe.
Yes.
All the best.
And then I played Danlett, which is a famous role. And I was lucky to be nominated for a Tosser, which is the highest acting award in Foon. The Tossers were just recently.
Mm-hmm. I thought there was some controversy that no other species was nominated except for humans.
Do you have whites in your world?
Do we have
whites? They're undead, but they're mysterious.
Oh, yes. W-I-G-H-T-S?
Yeah, how else?
You do have whites in your world?
I don't know.
The Tossers are dominated by whites.
Sure.
Because Tosser, it's called that because it's the person who can best toss off who they are and become something else. And that, people seem to think whites can do that very well because they're dead, so they're blank slates.
Sure. But you yourself are very good at tossing yourself off.
Yes. I frequently toss myself off.
Does it take a lot of practice?
It can, yeah. But I've been trained by Cocktickers. But I went to the Tossers, and it was, as usual, dominated by whites. And
do you mind walking us through, like, what is the morning of the Tossers?
Well,
like, how you're getting ready for this award show.
The hardest part is the red carpet, which is a carpet that by the end of the night is soaked in blood.
Oh, yeah.
Because a lot of people are jealous of other nominees.
Yeah.
And all weapons are allowed. That's why it's called the red carpet. But the problem is, that's why it's hard for someone like me. It's mostly whites. You can't kill them.
That's true.
You can't kill a white because they are dead. And we don't... It's sort of mysterious as to what they even are. Mm-hmm. And they look like people that you used to know. But they're not those people. They're whites.
Yeah.
I do have to say, though, in defense of whites, they can just walk through walls.
First of all,
impressive on stage.
I don't think that this is a proper time culturally to be speaking in defense of whites.
Yeah, I've never heard
I think it's time for whites to just listen.
Well, just because just because they're dead, it's not their fault.
Yeah, but that's the thing about whites. They're so like they're martyring themselves about, it's like, oh, I'm dead. It's like, you know what? You've got a lot of advantages as
yes.
a white.
Yes. Anyway, so those of us who are living have a very difficult time on the red carpet because we're the ones whose blood gets spilled.
It's so weird. I feel so confused.
Why are you confused?
I don't know, because like the setup for the, it's so, there are many levels of like setup and mediation before you get to the joke. I don't, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like you've got like Arnie and Chunt or whatever, and then like the Burger King, and then Fifoon, and then like there's a guy who's probably actually an actor pretending to be an actor in this other place. I was like, I don't understand what all this setup is for. But I thought the jokes about the white people was funny, and the blood-soaked carpet was funny. It reminded me of like, oh, my poor son. I shouldn't say it. Well, but like, you know, he doesn't have like his own computer and he's not really allowed to play. He does play video games mm-hmm. like on the computer, but he doesn't have the games other kids have.
Mm-hmm.
And so sometimes when I pick him up from school, from after school, he's playing basically video games, but on paper.
Mm-hmm.
So they're like drawing all the things and then doing like different, like I'm almost on another level, but they're just drawing stuff and like describing what's happening as they're drawing.
Yeah.
And it reminded me of that a little bit. Like the blood-soaked carpet was just like, and all weapons are allowed. And now, but now you have to go over this hill. And then, no, you're not at the thing yet. No, you missed. And it's like, you're drawing it. How can you miss? You know what I mean? But like, anyway, it's funny. It reminded me of that.
I did improv when I was a small child, when I was like in elementary school. I think there's a photo
of
me. Yeah, they had a Second City in Detroit, which is like, I'm from the Detroit area. The idea of yes and, just like continuously just building on something.
Right, like you're not supposed to sort of close off ideas or openings
mm-hmm.
to a new thing.
That's the scariest part. Yeah, that's definitely the scariest part. But
yeah.
I guess it makes something more rewarding. So we are going to shift from improv to, I'm sorry to say this, but naturally crime.
Oh, okay.
So the next clip is coming from the New Yorker Radio Hour. So this is a podcast made by WNYC and the writers and editors of the magazine The New Yorker. This clip is an interview with writer Jeffrey Toobin and actor Cuba Gooding Jr., who recently played O.J. Simpson on the FX series The People versus O.J. Simpson. So I love this clip because a lot of times when a criminal case gets really big, it becomes this moment that everybody is kind of a part of. And in this clip, you get to hear about how Cuba experienced the OJ scandal at the time, like as a young black man, but then, you know, I had a different experience as an actor later down the line. So the first voice you're going to hear in this clip is David Remnick, who is the editor of The New Yorker, setting the scene of the infamous televised OJ chase.
More than 20 years ago, a white Bronco with OJ Simpson in the passenger seat took a long, meandering drive down a Los Angeles freeway with the LAPD in pursuit and the entire country watching on television.
This is Larry King as we stay atop this scene.
We're seeing a car that's been pulling up, pulling back, and now we see the white Bronco take off at a speed that's considerably faster than it's been driving before. But look at the people standing on the freeway there, waving.
And one of the things that transformed it from an L.A. celebrity trial into a national story about race and justice was Jeffrey Toobin's coverage of the events in The New Yorker. The book Toobin eventually wrote about the Simpson trial, The Run of His Life, is the primary source of the FX series. In the course of consulting on the show, Toobin got to know Cuba Gooding Jr., who plays O.J. Simpson, and they met up the other day to compare notes, starting with what happened to Gooding's voice.
It sounds like this for the past 3-4 months. I think it's something I did in this room.
Is that true? I really do.
I went to an ENT and put that tube down my throat and looked at my vocal cords and they were like, "It's a little red, but no."
Well, you think there was one scene in particular that you may have lost it? I mean, you may have damaged your voice?
It was one of those things. As you know, there was not more than 3 or 4 days that would pass where I'd have to yell. And we, you know, when you're doing a scene, you yell take after take after take after take.
So let me start with your experience with the backstory. Mm-hmm. Now, you know, one of the things I think all of us involved in this project get used to is what I think of as the official question, which is, where were you during the Bronco chase?
Right.
Where were you during the Bronco chase?
I was watching the next game, one of the playoff games, at a party with a bunch of people. And I remember we had the game on a big screen, and in the corner of the screen, they cut to an image of the Bronco on the freeway.
So what'd you think when you were watching it?
I was, you know, a lot of things, you know. I had identified with the fact that he was an African-American personality, celebrity, and he was being accused of something that he might not have done. So I remember announcing that they had reached a verdict. And I remember holding my breath and them saying not guilty and feeling a huge sigh of relief.
Explain that. Why? Because why did you feel like
I didn't care if he did it or not. I just didn't want them to accuse another black man for a crime he didn't commit. White men get off all the time. Rich men get off all the time. This is one of our heroes.
You later felt guilty. Why did you feel guilty?
I did, because I never once did I consider the families. I never considered the Goldman families. I never considered the Browns. You know, whether you believe he did it or not, there were two families' lives that were shattered.
The ambivalence you're describing of, you know, in the different ways you reacted to the verdict, it reminds me of your performance, because your portrayal of O.J. is not just the guilty murderer and not just the charismatic innocent man. You can see him through different perspectives.
Well, I know that's the agreement that Ryan and I had come to terms with.
That's Ryan Murphy, who was one of the executive producers.
That's right.
And what was that agreement?
Ryan and I got to a place during filming where it was almost like a shorthand. Like, he would walk up to me and whisper before take, "Okay, this time I want you to experience the guilt of what you did." You know, and then he'd come back and say, "All right, now this time I want you to experience the frustration because, you know, your son did it." Or, you know, it was like little things like that would just set me in. You know, it's funny, for the longest time, I would hear actors talk about how it was difficult to shake a character, and I always thought it was bullshit. Mm-hmm. I remember Heath Ledger said it with the Joker character.
Right.
And after this role, I understood it. I truly understood that you go through a psychosis, and it literally took me, I don't know, months maybe. And, you know, it's so funny because I'm still today haunted by certain frame of minds I don't want to put myself in. You know, there's this wonderful series called Making of a Murderer that I have not watched because I just can't go there. I'm not ready to allow myself to indulge in that again.
Yeah.
And that's why I probably won't watch this for a while. You ever seen a movie and you start to cry in a movie? Well, think about it, you're an actor and what got you to that emotional place. You go there again, you know?
That stressed me out.
How?
I don't know. I feel like it's going to sound sort of like grandiose or something if I say it. And I don't want it to sound grandiose. But the thing that he's saying about, like, not being able to watch the making of a murderer... Mm-hmm. Like, I haven't watched it either, mm-hmm. even though, you know, I have all these people are saying I haven't watched The Jinx. Like, I don't, my heart is beating so fast right now. Hearing that, I can't invest in, like, a violent thing for a while, I feel like. It's really, I find it really upsetting. All parts of it. I mean, not just like the violence of it, and also remembering how incredibly bloody that. I haven't seen this series. You know, this O.J. one.
Yeah, American Crime Story. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, I remember the coverage at the time, right? And I just remember my memory of it anyway was that it was an intensely bloody crime scene, and I don't know. I just don't want to. I don't want to be in it. And I don't know, just when Cuba Gooding Jr. was just talking about sort of when an event like that happens, it's sort of, it's like an explosion, you know?
Yeah.
And I feel like it just, the aftershocks and the reverberations are so much wider than I think we like to think about.
Mm-hmm.
And trying to capture that in, you know, making a TV series or making a podcast or making a documentary story of any kind is hard. But I think, like, that's the thing I'm always trying to do. So maybe I'm just having a stressed out feeling about, like, being on deadline or something. Like, oh, my God, I'm back at work.
No, but it's almost like the thing that you say about, like, something that you run into in the People versus OJ or the kind of work that you do with Serial, sort of like recontextualizing something that has already happened, specifically something where, you know, the people affected by the situation or the event, many of them are still alive. You're not putting this narrative out into a vacuum.
Right. Yeah. You're so aware of how everybody in the story is hearing it and then having to go back to them. After, you know what I mean? You're not done. You can't be like, oh, all right, well, that story's done. Moving right along. You know,
like, there's never a point where you're just like, oh, I'm done. It's out there. There's nothing I can do.
Right. And making those episodes, I have all of the people in my head all at once, you know, for a really long time. I have to answer to them. You're always like bracing yourself a little bit for like, okay, if I use this quote, how are these like seven different people going to respond?
Mm-hmm.
You know, am I prepared for that response?
Yeah.
And do I have a good answer? And do I, you know what I mean? It's just, so it's like, it's stressful.
Well, something I think about in the difference between Serial seasons one and two, in season two, I guess like used a lot of Bo Bergdahl talking from, you know, 25 hours of reporting by Mark Bull. But in season one, like the central character seems to be Adnan Syed. You guys had plenty of phone conversations directly. You know, Cuba Gooding Jr. said something about being haunted in a way by this role and how there are certain things, same with you, that he doesn't necessarily want to talk about or experience or watch or listen to. Do you feel a difference in the way that you relate to the narratives of season one and season two because you maybe were in closer proximity to the main subject of season one than you were to the main subject of season two?
I feel like the answer should be yes, mm-hmm. but not really is the truth.
Really?
I mean, yeah, it was just really different. You know, the relationship between Anon and me and Bo and me, it's so different. With Anon, his case was already more or less done. I mean, it turns out it's not done, and he's had this kind of whole second phase now that's currently going on. But at the time, you know, this was 15 years ago, and I think he's settled in, unfortunately, for anybody, but settled into a life in prison. Like, he knows what his life is, and he knows more or less, like, what his future is, mm-hmm. maybe. I mean, maybe something, you know, will happen and he'll you know, his life will change. But mm-hmm. but basically, he's sort of pretty well accepted where he is. And there was something about Bo being so in this liminal place in his life where he just has no idea what's about to happen to him.
Mm.
And is still, you know, he was held for 5 years, basically, like, in a hole, and then by the Taliban. And then he comes back to the United States, and he's not in jail or anything, but he is confined. I think in sort of every way a person can be confined. And it's sad to me.
On that note, we're going to take a quick break. And when we get back, I want to talk to you about how Serial has affected your life. Welcome back to Sampler. My guest today is Sarah Koenig, who I have been affectionately referring to as Mother Podcast. And we're talking about the lessons she learned from working on Serial, and we're playing clips from shows that have all been created since Serial Season 1 first aired. Okay, so getting back into things, the idea of serializing a narrative is a really old idea. Like, the first thing that comes to mind is, like, when I had to read Tale of Two Cities when I was in the ninth grade, you know, like Charles Dickens releasing a chapter of it every week, you know what I'm saying? Leaving people with a cliffhanger. But telling a story in a serialized fashion on a podcast and in real time, Like, how do you manage something like that?
It's not like we said ready, set, go, and we just start reporting and producing the podcast at the same time. So especially for season one, I mean, I reported for a good year before we started making any episodes and releasing them. That was slightly less true for season two. So I had done a lot of reporting, but there was still, a pretty good chunk left to do when we started season two. That said, it's ridiculously stressful.
Yeah. Why decide to do a serialized show in the first place?
Julie and I had been talking for a long time about trying to do a new show.
Uh-huh.
And I really like books on tape. That's what I love, is just getting lost in a narrative like that over time, chapter by chapter,
yeah.
And it just, like, you can do anything when you're absorbed in a story. I just wanted to basically make a book on tape. But I'm not a fiction writer. I'm a reporter.
Yeah.
So I was like, well, we'll just do it with nonfiction.
And then you have Serial.
Yeah. That's all it is. It's just a nonfiction book on tape. Julie really hates it when I talk about it being like a book on tape. She's like, shut up about that. That does not sound exciting.
No, it sounds cool. It sounds in-depth and lengthy. Something about like the idea of like a constant cliffhanger. Thinking of Serial as kind of like Serial was like the first thing that sort of like expanded my idea of what podcasting as a narrative could do. You know, you covered so much and in so much detail.
Mm-hmm.
What was it like to have to follow all of that up in season two?
Oh, like, was I worried about like being a flop in season two?
I mean, I guess you could put it that way. But even, even with just the, were you worried about, repeat success?
Not really. I felt pretty sure that whatever story we chose for season two would be really, really different. So I knew that we would probably lose those people who were just really into that genre of story. And I'm such an idiot. I didn't totally understand how much people like a crime story. I know it sounds really dumb and like faux naive or something, but I just didn't. I had not really even heard of the term true crime before.
Really?
I don't consider myself like a crime reporter. So it's not my thing. So, but I realize it is for a lot of people and that we would lose a percentage of those people.
Mm-hmm.
So I was ready for that. And that was fine with me. Honestly, a little less attention and sort of less intense attention was welcome. we were a little excited about that, of just like, can we just, not have so many people kind of like looking over our shoulder as we make this thing, in which sounds obnoxious, but it, some of that was stressful, where it was just like, a million think pieces on of like, well, what does it mean? And is it right? And, are they doing something unethical? Or, it was a little bit like, oh. So, and I also feel like if you love the story you're working on, other people are going to come with you, because that's infectious when someone is really, really interested and curious about something, no matter what it is. It's funny because I feel like the narrative in the media, weirdly, about season two has been like, not as popular. And it's like, I'm actually not sure that's true. Like, according to our numbers, that's not true.
Ooh.
So it's funny, like, I'll see things in the press that are like, I actually thought season two was good. And I'm like, yeah, it's really good. Season two is really good. Like, you can lose the actually. It's really good.
Speaking of season two.
Did I tell you it's good?
I think I did. I think I
did
got
it. Did you get that?
I think I got it. I think we got that one on tape. speaking of season two may not have been for the true crime bloodthirsty set, but a big audience that was interested in season two is the military. And so our next clip actually comes from a podcast called Task and Purpose. So Task and Purpose is a podcast which is a part of a larger website, an online resource for the new veterans coming out of Iraq and Afghanistan. And they analyzed the episodes from like a different perspective than the average listener. And this next clip features co-host Nate Bethay. He's a former U.S. infantry officer, and he served in the same battalion, actually, as Bo Bergdahl. And host Lauren Katzenberg. And she asks Nate about his overall impressions of Serial Season 2.
Okay. If you had to point to one specific plotline, reveal, or interview from this season and say, wow, that's impressive, that's good journalism, what would it be?
I think the background information on Bergdahl. I think that the way that they dug through his family life and were able to get people to speak very frankly about him, his people from home. I know those episodes were not necessarily the most popular, and it's hard to divorce that from the sort of geopolitical discussion that this invariably entails. But I think it would be very easy to just dismiss him as some sort of flyover state kook. And the fact that they really did the legwork and went there and found these people, and that they really did the legwork on finding people. I mean, some of them self-reported, but his Coast Guard, basic training comrades, it seemed to me that the easiest thing in the world for reporting the story is just to take the established narrative facts as a given. And so the fact that they really did go through and say, we're going to try and not treat anything in the story as a given, whether or not they succeeded can be debated, but I think that that's a worthy approach. And so in that regard, seeing how much attention they paid to his background and to giving the people who knew him and cared about him the opportunities to speak frankly, you know, which on a very unpopular topic, I might add, I think was to me evidence of honest journalism.
Okay, vice versa. Was there any plot point or storyline that you think Serial just never really got right?
I thought the episodes in which Mark Boal was the kind of cornerstone, and particularly that seemed to hit a low point with the episode that only concerned Bergdahl's escape attempts, in which, aside from very, very kind of loosely attributed interviews with Afghan civilians that they, you know, got second and third hand, the only source in that whole kind of gripping yarn was Bergdahl himself, who had a personally vested interest in making it read a certain way. But the way, I think for me, particularly during that episode specifically, where Sarah Koenig said, oh, these fighters working for the Haqqani network were shooting the shit just like young men in war anywhere. And it seemed like an implicit comparison between American soldiers and militants in the Afghan-Pakistan region. I came away from that feeling as though I wanted the Serial podcast to take on a corporeal form so that I could throw it into a volcano.
You know, I agree with his first point, and I don't agree with the second point. Shockingly. Yeah, I mean, yeah, it's interesting. I didn't listen. You know, I knew Task and Purpose was happening as a podcast about you know, the season, but I never listened to it, mostly because I just didn't want to get stressed out by it. It just struck me when Nate said, you know, the fact that we sort of talked to his family and got them to talk about him, you know, just like as a regular person and a human being with feelings. And he was like on such an incredibly unpopular topic.
Yeah.
And it's interesting because it's like, yeah, and you're in the military, but the rest of the world doesn't necessarily feel that way about Bo or what Bo did. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Like,
it's just a reminder that we're all in our own universes. By the same token, I mean the notion that we shouldn't be thinking about who our enemy is and why they are our enemy and if they're our enemy, mm-hmm. and why they do what they do. And, you know, that's somehow that they're a different creature from an American soldier. I don't buy that.
Do you receive or consider the feedback that you get from military personnel or from veterans? Do you consider that differently than you consider feedback from, you know, the wide breadth of your listeners?
Yeah, I do. It's their world I'm describing, mm-hmm. you know? Like our fact checker was showing it to somebody who's in the military or had been in the military or something to make sure just like even small things that we weren't just goofing up mm-hmm. small, you know, terminology or, I don't know, military concepts or something like that we wanted to be really sure like we were respecting their world and their experience as much as we could. A lot of them had a lot at stake in this story, mm-hmm. In all kinds of really complicated ways. And so, you know, yeah, of course you care what they think.
Okay, so we've arrived in our last clip.
Okay.
It's going to be
like hard one?
No. Totally different. So I said at the beginning of our conversation that sort of in the wake of Serial, this like there was just more space for this like strange new world of podcasting. And podcasting is just a place where you can just get as specific as you want, specific group of people, specific place, specific voice. And our next clip, I think, is really illustrative of that. So this next clip comes to us from a show called Sparkle and Circulate. It's a comedy and interview podcast, and it's basically a celebration of the LGBTQ community. So in the clip, you're going to hear host Justin Sayer talk about his trip to Italy and shopping for a rather unique souvenir.
We were in Venice over Christmas. I know, I sound so fancy, but literally there's like a wrapped up cheeseburger in my purse right now. Do not feel as though I am leaving you for greater things. I'd kill somebody for a cronut right now. There's nothing happening. So I'm in Venice with my two friends. And we're traipsing around, and I'm in this huge, huge gray felt hat and this jacket that I had bought there. And these two kind of shapeless shirts that I bought in a ladies' underwear store in Rome that I loved, loved, loved. Anyway, so we go into this little vintage shop in Venice, and I love a brooch. I love a pin of some sort. I think it dresses up a jacket. I think it's just spectacular. And I go to the desk. And the thing about shopping in Europe is that even though men's clothing is a little more adventurous in Europe, there is kind of a line. Like, I go in an Ann Taylor Loft in New York, and this is the truth. And I run things in there. I'll have one of those, I'll have some of those, and don't look at me askance because I'm paying for it. And they're fine with it. They don't care. You know, they're happy that somebody's buying Ann Taylor Loft, really. But in Italy, it was a little more, I had to play it a little, you know, the Catholic Church is there, so we have to be careful. So I go over and they have a whole tray of brooches, right? And ladies and gentlemen, there is a brooch that I bought that I can't even believe it exists. It is a small rabbit, right, laying on its side with its ass, you know, just curded up, kind of just kicked up a little, like you put in your Craigslist ad when you're having a bunch of men over. The position you'd be laying if you were just presenting to the open doorway. You understand what I'm saying. You know. And the rabbit in one hand is holding a bouquet of flowers and looking askance at his, you know, kicked up ass. And then in his other hand, he's just leaning luxuriously on his cheek. Now, that in itself is provocative in a way that I had not expected a rabbit pin to be. But what kicks it all off, ladies and gentlemen, is one of his ears is pierced with a pearl. So I saw this brooch of a gay, sexually adventurous rabbit. And I was like, I've never wanted anything more in my life. So I start bargaining with this woman, and she's like, well, maybe 30. I'm like, 30, fine, whatever you're going to charge me. And she's like, well, you know, it's kind of, I don't know if you really like it. She's trying to talk me out of it because she thinks for some reason that maybe I don't deserve the gay brooch. But let me tell you, ladies and gentlemen, I'm a 34-year-old gay man. I deserve that brooch. And I bought it. And I wear it to this day. And it's a little hallmark of a new trend in my life where I'm just going to only become more myself, much like that bunny presenting its ass to the world.
That's funny. Nice to get a gentle reminder every once in a while just to be yourself. Do you?
There are many odd things about that. I like it. I liked it. I was hoping for a better story, but I enjoyed the presentation.
I'm glad that we were able to at least show you something new.
He did a really good job explaining that rabbit.
Yeah. I think the thing that got me is the pearl earring. You never think about bunnies wearing jewelry.
Yeah. But bargaining with someone is not saying it'll be 30. Okay. That was the wrong use of bargaining. I was hoping for a real bargaining story, but other than that quibble with his verb, he could have just said, I bought it, but he, you know. Yeah, anyway.
But then what's the fun in saying that you bought something?
Yeah. I know. Well, right. I know.
Okay. I picked up a souvenir on vacation. Not as much fun as saying that you bought it.
Exactly. But I feel like he totally won me with the cheeseburger, so which I thought was a smart move, very smart move. And then, yeah, I just really, really enjoyed the description of the rabbit.
Are clips like that what you had in mind when you published the first episode of Serial? Like, you know what? I'm going to come out here. I'm going to shake some things up, bust open the podcasting world so that people can talk about purchasing rabbit brooches on their...
Power to them. I'm like, more the merrier. We got the space. Like, yes, absolutely. That's what I think is great about podcasting, is just like that spirit of like, try anything is great. Like, I think that's great.
Well, Sarah, you had a good time? You enjoyed yourself? That's such a leading question. I feel like you can flag that as a journalist and be like, that's leading.
Oh, it's way more than leading. It's like, it's a trap.
But Sarah, thank you so, so much for talking to me today.
Oh, pleasure.
I genuinely appreciate it. Are you taking any pitches for season 3?
Yeah.
Prince. I would love it if you reported on Prince and what happened to him.
So many questions.
If you haven't already, you can and should listen to the full seasons of Serial 1 and 2 wherever you get podcasts. And to recap the clips you heard in this post-Serial podcast, Tidal Wave, we started off the journey with magic, improv, and red carpets with Hello from the Magic Tavern. Cuba Gooding Jr. got personal in the New Yorker Radio Hour. We heard a veteran's take on Serial Season 2 from Task and Purpose, and we learned about the world's most incredible rabbit brooch from Sparkle and Circulate. Stay tuned after the credits to hear what Sampler has in store for you next week. This episode was produced by Rose Reed, Sarah Abdurrahman, and myself, with help from Kate Parkinson Morgan. It was edited by Annie Rose Strasser. Our theme music was made by Mike Avellian, and our ad music was made by Mark Phillips. The show was mixed by Matthew Bull. And special thanks to Nick Thorburn and the same Mark Phillips I just said who did our ad music, who made the scores for Serial. And thanks to Dave Kestenbaum for sending the podcast Hello from the Magic Tavern our way. Sampler is a production of Gimlet Media. Next week on Sampler, I finally get to sit down with the people who inspired me to get into podcasting. Hosts of The Read, Kid Fury, and Crystal.
Oh, you're talking about us.
I'm talking about y'all.
Oh. I was like, oh, this must be a really great show.
Oh, thank you.
Okay, thanks.
This is very kind.